Sometimes in football, you need just a little more for that first down. You need to be pushing the pile. And on our new podcast, we'll give you that extra effort.
I'm Mike Renner, a longtime NFL analyst who helped develop player evaluation systems that every NFL team uses to this day.
And I'm Kyle Long, former all-pro offensive lineman in the NFL who knows a thing or two about getting people moving.
You'll get expertise from inside the trenches and behind the tape for 4 episodes every week. So make sure you download and subscribe to the Pushing the Pile podcast on the Audio.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to WFAN's Baseball Insiders for Monday, July 25th. I'm Sweeney Murdy, and I'm joined today by Anthony McCarron, my colleague at SNY. It's the return of the M&M boys. And Anthony, that is a great place to start. Aaron Judge is closing in on 40. I firmly believe, and I think many of us have for a while, that he's going to legitimately make a run at 60 and 61 and start challenging Roger Maris for what is still the American League home run record, what is still the Yankees home run record. And I think that still matters, even if he doesn't hit 70 or 73. I think there's still some, because of the other issues that have been tied to those marks, the PED questions about it, I think there's still some legitimate excitement about seeing Aaron Judge try to get to 60, 61, Ruth, Maris, kinds of numbers. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely agree, Sweeney. I think it'll be very, very closely watched. And I think fans, especially Yankee fans, but even baseball fans in general, will really get into it. It's going to reignite the debate over what's the real home run record. You know what the record books say, that Barry Bonds has it. But there are people who feel like, you know, Maris is still the clean record holder all these years later. And so if Judge hits 65, you know, some people in their own minds are going to push that to be the all-time record. It's going to be interesting and fun to talk about. I think he has a real chance to do it. I think he's locked in that way. If he stays healthy, he's going to make a run. We're all going to be paying attention. It's just amazing to see the names he's associated with each time he goes out of the ballpark. You know, I mean, it just, you know, the ones you mentioned before, Ruth, Mantle, you know, Maris, all these guys on Yankee lists. And, you know, of course, if he does complete this, it'll be one of the greatest home run seasons in baseball history, bar none. I wonder if there'll be a media watch, you know, where more and more outlets will go just to see if he does it. I mean, I don't know if we'll see a repeat of 98, because that was a different media era and a different excitement about that record, maybe. But it could be something to watch, and it'll all be going on against the backdrop of this Yankee team sort of raging through the schedule, playing great, you know, thinking about the World Series. Their fans certainly are already, and rightfully so. So there's a ton to really dig into with Judge. And, you know, look, this guy is doing this, Sweeney, with, and you know, this has been a hot topic all year, with a strike zone that does not favor the hitter.
Yeah,
and he has gotten, you know, we've seen it. You've seen it. You hear it on the broadcast, and you hear the moans of fans, you know, when an umpire calls a strike below Judge's knees. And if he were getting half the calls that he's not getting, Sweeney, I mean, would he have 50 already? I don't know. That's how good he's been this year.
I think, you know, part of the issue, and I still haven't figured out how to quantify it. There are people smarter than me, and hopefully would, because I've been digging around on this a little bit, but haven't really nailed it down yet. He also benefits from the upper part of the zone. There are pitches that probably are strikes to him that do not get called strikes. Now, there aren't as many because there aren't as many pitchers trying to go up in the zone on him for obvious reasons.
You
miss by a little and the ball goes 500 feet. You know, it's easier to try to get him out lower in the zone, which is why he ends up seeing more of those pitches and umpires miss more of those pitches. But I think an interesting part of it as he goes through this is, you know, you mentioned, you know, the clean home run record. There are still people who will put Hank Aaron's name above Barry Bonds, and just talking about them shines a greater light on Hank Aaron's career and what that number meant. And I think bringing Roger Maris's name back into the conversation is important too. I think that's what we all seem to get out of when someone chases a record. It's not just about the new person eclipsing it. It's right. about shining a light on the old mark and bringing back that player's achievements and accomplishments. And I think Roger Maris saw some of that in 1998, but it started to get a little tainted because of the associations with McGuire and later Bonds. I think bringing his name and his achievements back up again is another wonderful part of this.
Absolutely, because he's an underappreciated player no matter what way you look at it, Sweeney. And he, you know, that record is one thing, and, you know, but he wasn't just that record. You know, he won the MVP 2 years in a row, which is something that not that many guys in baseball have done. He was an excellent defensive outfielder. I mean, I think he's got a claim to a Hall of Fame spot because of the place he holds in baseball history. No, he did not hit 500 home runs. No, he did not click any of the magic numbers. You know, but of a moment, he is a prime figure in baseball history. It would be nice to see him recognized in Cooperstown for that. And I don't think that that diminishes the Hall of Fame either. I know there's a lot of, there are some Hall of Very Good police out there who will be very unhappy with that statement. But I just think that his spot in the game's lore is really a nice thing. And he was an excellent player, played on a bunch of championship teams, terrific outfielder, you know, did something that not many people could do under that pressure. No one wanted him to break that record.
Yeah.
Everyone wanted the guy next to him to break that record, and Mickey Mantle, because Mickey was everyone's boyhood hero at that time. And understandably so, he's a larger than life figure and always will be. But Roger's the one who did it. You know, he stayed healthy. He was the one who, you know, was under this intense pressure, but he broke the record. He's the one who accomplished it. So, look, you're right. I love the fact that it reignites talk about him. And you mentioned Hank Aaron as well. Hank Aaron is the, to me, and this may sound strange because he, you know, he hit all those home runs, 3,000 hits. If you took away all of his home runs, he'd still have 3,000 hits, which is an incredible accomplishment.
Yeah.
But he is the most underappreciated all-time great player of all time to me, because he was so incredible for so long. And people don't talk about him maybe the way they ought to. You know, he gets plenty of plaudits and deservedly so. But I just, you know, man, he was something else. And what he went through when he broke Babe Ruth's record is just unimaginable. The racism and the pressure and everything that was going on with that, swirling around in a different era. You know, he is just, to me, one of the most laudable people who has ever had any association with Major League Baseball.
And it's for those, all those reasons that I love when records get challenged and we get to bring it all up again, because, you know, we're old. We know all about these things, but there are people who don't know about these things, younger fans that start to learn more. And it's just a wonderful part of the process of passing on that history. Bring it to more current times. Judge is helping his team to, at the moment, the best record in the league. The Yankees and the Mets are on the verge here of their first meeting of the year. And I think it's wonderful that we're doing it after the All-Star break, roughly 100 games into the season, where both of these teams are in position to think about a meeting in October. So as the Yankees and Mets get set to take on each other for the first time, they'll do it again a month from now at Yankee Stadium. Are you still feeling this possible preview? Are you still feeling excitement? Because listen, you and I have attended a lot of Yankees Mets games over the course of the last 20 years or so, haven't had as much excitement because they already met in the 2000 World Series. Both teams were never this good at the same time. And dreaming of postseason, are you feeling the energy? Are you excited to see these two teams play each other again?
Sweeney, you hit on it. The fact that they're both so good and they might actually be the best team in each of their respective leagues, that gives it a little extra pump for me, because we haven't had that in a while. This series has always meant something to fans, and they are always excited about it because they all know somebody who's, you know, if you're a Met fan, you know somebody who's a Yankee fan, you know, bah, 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 bah. They're talking back and forth, you know, and, you know, privately Met fans say, we can't lose to the Yankees. And privately Yankee fans say, you know, we can't lose to the Mets. We can't give them a leg up. You know, nothing like that. So it's always been meaningful for them. I think, you know, to the outside world, there's probably Subway Series fatigue, you know, for interleague play. But this year, it's, to me, it's a real measuring stick. Maybe the players won't look at it as a measuring stick, because, or at least they'll lip service it that it's not a measuring stick. You know, we don't look at it this way. It's another game on the schedule. There's a long way to go. Okay, thanks. you know, the outside will look at it as a measuring stick. You know, I mean, if the Mets go and clobber the Yankees and sweep all four, why wouldn't our opinion of the Mets go way up? Absolutely. Absolutely. So I think there's real heat here for the first time in a long time. You know, the rivalry hasn't had the provocateurs that it had in the past either. You know, I mean, Bobby Valentine was great at getting under everybody's skin, right, when he was the Met manager. And that was part of his style. And part of what made him a good manager, I think, is that he annoyed people into not playing as well as they could possibly play against him sometimes, and it worked for him. We don't really have that. There's no Roger Clemens, Mike Piazza feud that we're like all breathlessly waiting to see the next chapter of. So if it takes the teams to both be great to give this thing a little more sizzle, I'm all for it. And I think we're in a good spot, and I can't wait to see the games.
I love your take on what how the players respond to our questions leading up to it. And I remember, you know, I mean, listen, how many times did we ask Jeter and Posada, specifically those two, who just hated seeing us walk up to their lockers a day before a Mets series or a Red Sox series, even, because they didn't like the questions. But they also, in turn, would later tell you how much they loved playing in hostile environments, in front of large crowds, in front of, you know, whether it was playoffs or World Series or Subway Series, where you're talking about all the attention. So clearly, they were just tired of us talking to them about it, but they loved playing in the environment. And I think that's something that stands out, that they just didn't want to admit, because they, you know, they were trying to focus on actually winning the games as opposed to talking about the games. But clearly they loved playing in that environment. And I think that these current players will grudgingly admit to that too. Listen, they all do, Anthony. When the stands are full, the energy is there. They all feel it, and they love playing it. And they show you that on the field. They show you that by their excitement. They just don't like talking about it beforehand.
Right. I did a story for the Daily News back in June about, you know, kind of a look back to the first ever meeting when interleague play started. And, you know, that's what all the players that I talked to said. You know, the atmosphere was unbelievable. It was so great to play in that. So you're absolutely right. They don't want the sort of pain, I guess, of talking about it. And, you know, they're also, you know, I'm sure they're also thinking, you know, I don't want to say anything that somebody's going to take as bulletin board material, and then it's going to be a thing, and then I have to deal with that as the whole thing goes along. But you're absolutely right. I mean, what would they rather have, you know, 4,000 people there? And, you know, so you could hear the one crazy guy, you know, in the upper deck screaming at the one guy he's got a grudge at. You know, I mean, that's amusing, you know, for a half an inning, but it's not amusing for, you know, a whole series of games, when you'd rather have that taut excitement in the air and the sort of October feel to it. And, you know, that's what you really play for. And that's what those guys really crave.
Sometimes in football, you need just a little more for that first down. You need to be pushing the pile. And on our new podcast, we'll give you that extra effort.
I'm Mike Renner, a longtime NFL analyst who helped develop player evaluation systems that every NFL team uses to this day.
And I'm Kyle Long, former All-Pro offensive lineman in the NFL, who knows a thing or two about getting people moving.
You'll get expertise from inside the trenches and behind the tape for 4 episodes every week. So make sure you download and subscribe to the Pushing the Pile podcast on the Odyssey.
I think it's interesting too, the spacing of these two series. As I said, they're meeting, you know, roughly around the 100 game mark or so. They're going to meet another month from now, which is after the trade deadline. So these two series are going to look kind of dramatically different, or could potentially look dramatically different, based on the makeup of the rosters, on what the Yankees do at the deadline, what the Mets do at the deadline, if DeGrom comes back in time for that second series, right, a month from now. It could change the way these two teams are looking at each other. So I guess my question for you is this, Anthony: who has to go for it more at the trade deadline, the Yankees or the Mets. The Mets are a team that's on the build, and even if they don't get there this year, you know that with Buck Showalter, with Steve Cohen, with all of that, everything they have riding, they feel like they're a team on the rise, whereas the Yankees have kind of been building for this for the last 5 years and have Aaron Judge's free agency hanging out there. I know my answer is the Yankees have to go for it more at the deadline. What do you think?
Well, you know, I can't sort of separate that concept from the fact that I think the Mets are the needier team because I think they have more fixable holes right now that they need to do something about if they're serious about making it to the World Series and winning the World Series. The overriding thing for me, Sweeney, with the Mets is they've won the World Series twice in 60 years of play. They have a team right now that is good enough to win the World Series if they do some things to supplement, okay? But they've got to make sure that they have patched any of the holes. I think their bullpen is shy right now, and they really need to hit that. And I think that they could use more offense, too. I mean, the numbers are stark. They're still generating runs. They're sixth in runs per game. But over the past, you know, month, 6 weeks or so, their offense has really slid back. I know they made the Daniel Vogelbach trade, and that's a good move. You know, effectiveness against right-handed pitching for him and some slugging. You know, they're 19th in home runs. That's a huge difference between them and the Yankees. The Yankees are obviously first in homers, but the Mets, when they're put the ball in play approach, doesn't work one night, you know, they have one guy in the lineup who can blow the game open, and that's Pete Alonso. The Yankees have that up and down their lineup, and they've got more power potential. They hit more home runs. They slug more. That's the problem for the Mets. So I think they need to do something about that or try to do something about that. That's why I think that's my answer, that 2-60 means urgency ought to be there. And believe me, I get what you're saying about the Aaron Judge uncertainty beyond this season, and this may be the time. I mean, we're all, every Yankee fan in the world is still smarting over the fact that they haven't won since 2009, as if like a World Series every 2 or 3 years is a birthright if you are a pinstripe fan. Hey, it's a lot harder than that. So give them credit for all the championships that they've won over the years, including the ones in the past 25 years or so. So look, they both have holes to me. I think the Mets need to do more to lock down those holes.
Listen, Anthony, do not make light of the fact that every elementary school in the tri-state area is filled with kids who have never seen the Yankees win a World Series in their lifetime. Come on now.
Those poor kids.
They're suffering. When I look back on this now, though, I think that it's an interesting deadline because both the Yankees and Mets jockeying for position. And I think back to 2000, which you covered as a beat writer for the Daily News. And I'm wondering if you have any memories of how that went back and forth. Because remember, it was also a different, it was, you know, pre-internet, pre-social media, all of that. So the deadline was treated differently when you had to pick up the back page of the paper each morning and see what was happening back and forth. And you lived a certain pressure with that. You know, the Yankees made their biggest deal for David Justice a month before the deadline, but it was still surrounded by a lot of different intrigue with whether or not they're going to go for Sammy Sosa or Juan Gonzalez or, you know, a couple other names I think were out there. The Mets needed a shortstop because of the injury to Ray Ordonez, and they had a Barry Larkin deal in place, which fell through. They ended up getting Mike Bordick from the Orioles.
Right.
So there was some jockeying back and forth with those two teams with needs because they saw October in their future. I'm wondering what memory jumps out at you about specifically covering the Yankees during that time.
Well, it is the 2000 deadline, Sweeney, because as you say, that was my first year on the beat. And of course, you know that the Yankees are a big deal. And I had done plenty of Yankees backup coverage before that, you know, so you know the kind of excitement that there is around the team when they're going well. Everybody in the world is reading the paper, more stories and more stories, you know, give us more. What else you got? What else you got? That was a daily refrain at the Daily News. I got this, this and this. Well, how about this and this? Can you do something on that? But anyway, so that 2000 deadline, you know, and you're right, leading up to the deadline, I'm including that part as the deadline part two, because the fact of the matter, the fact that you brought the two names up, Juan Gonzalez, who of course was a terrifying power hitter of that era, and then Sammy Sosa, couple years removed from, you know, the great home run chase and everything. These are the names popping up. So, like, this is a great introduction to being the beat writer on the team, that you're talking about two incredible home run hitters as potential guys for the, it wasn't just, you know, Joey Walnuts for the bullpen and Joe Schoblotnick to maybe come off the bench. You know, it was, you know, the two of the biggest names in the sport, and then they're, you know, jockeying back and forth. And then the Justice trade happens, and the backstory on the Justice trade was so phenomenal that it just has always stuck with me, because it, you know, David Justice wasn't, quote, available. It wasn't out there that he was a guy who the Indians were going to trade. But Brian Cashman called the Indians to talk about getting a championship ring to a coach who had been on, Gary Tuck, who had been on the staff the year before. Hey, we want to get him his ring. How can we do that? Oh, what's going on? What's the deadline going to look for you guys? You know, one thing leads to another, and all of a sudden, David Justice is a Yankee. And it turned out he had an incredible impact on that team. I think he hit 20 home runs in the second half. Yep. And, you know, was a terrific clutch player for them, had an enormous home run in the playoffs as well. I believe that's the famous Michael K call, right? Get your tokens.
Get your tokens ready.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, it was a great trade for them. And that really sort of crystallized, you know, I had plenty of experience covering the Yankees by that time, because, I mean, that's dog years right there. You know, when you do that, like a couple months, you're like, yeah, I've been on this beat for like 22 years because it's a grind. You know, that sort of brought it home. You know, are they going to trade for Sosa? Are they going to trade for Juan Gonzalez? Wait, David Justice out of nowhere? So it was something else to see. And, you know, it's always happening with the Yankees, because I remember even in those days, you know, they traded for Aaron Boone. They got Raul Mondesi at one point. Jeff Weaver was a big deal. I remember how excited they were about getting Jeff Weaver. They thought he was an up and comer. And then, you know, to me, you know, I don't know what your memory of this is, Sweeney, but I just remember that it felt like Jeff Weaver didn't pitch well when he first got there. So they were like, oh, this guy's awful. I mean, from the Yankees standpoint, like, I think that they kept taking him out of the rotation and putting him in the rotation, and they had so many pitchers and, you know, they never just let him be and pitch. And I think he probably would have been better if they had done that. But every start is like this magnified thing. And people talk about the media attention and everything. But inside that organization, there's a giant microscope for everything like that. So if a guy has, you know, a rough outing, you know, all of a sudden it's like, we really got to think about this guy.
Yeah, and I think it was magnified then, because it wasn't social media or media pressure. It was just Steinbrenner pressure.
Right.
He's watching every game a lot differently and had people around him and just screaming at the people next to him about this guy and that guy. You know, the thing that always sticks out to me about Weaver, and I joke with this about with Mark Feinstein about this, in, you know, whatever rough start he got off to in 01 in spring of 2002, and then in spring of 2003, he actually looks really good. He looks amazing. And this is kind of my spring training cautionary tale all the time. He looks so good in the spring of 03 that I'm on the air with Mike and the Mad Dog saying he's going to win 18 games. And, you know, they think I'm nuts. And, well, I guess they were right, because I think it took him like 2 years to win 18 games. He didn't win 18 for the Yankees after that total. So, because, you know, spring training is different, and, people play differently in the pressure. We're seeing that now with Joey Gallo. You know, he does not play well in New York. And that just seems to be part of the, you know, something you can't tell until you see it, which is another fascinating part of the trade deadline stuff, is that you can bring in this guy and that guy.
Right.
Until he actually gets there, you're not going to know what he's going to look like once he sees 40 people around his locker before his first game.
Right.
And then what happens when he goes 0-for-4 the first time, or gives up, to your point about Weaver. Okay. He gives up a couple of runs his first time, and it's a lot different than doing it in Detroit or in Texas or someplace else.
Sure. And that, to me, Sweeney, is a great example of why, if David Robertson is not on either the Mets or the Yankees by the trade deadline, then both teams ought to reevaluate the way they approach the deadline, because that guy has got the guts to handle New York. He's proven it two times over with the Yankees, and he's having a great year with the Cubs. Yeah. He's fully healthy now. He's got a sub-2 ERA. He really looks sharp. I can't imagine that one of the teams doesn't add him. unless they're just outbid for, you know, they're outbid by another team, another contender who needs relief. And look, they're Sweeney, they're all going to need relief pitching, every contender, because the way the COVID seasons have gone and how workloads have gone up and down, innings limits, attacking everybody's pitching staff, all of that sort of thing, you know, injuries are cropping up now, you know, the shortened spring training, all that stuff is coming into play now. And so contenders, I think the relief market is going to be wild, and it should be. And look, so, you know, the Yankees and Mets ought to just make a deal for that guy now.
I think we wring our hands around bullpen a lot, but I don't think it's unique or unusual, because, you know, I just keep thinking back to this, is that, you know, we're talking about what the Yankees with their bullpen, what the Mets with their bullpen, but go back and look at the last, you know, handful of World Series championship teams, right? The Braves, the Dodgers, the Astros, the Red Sox, the Cubs, all of them had bullpen issues. Even as they were having great regular seasons, they were all right, trying to figure out, what do we do with the closer? What do we do with this? There are all kinds of bullpen issues with those teams. And some of them didn't figure out until they got to October, shorten their starting rotation and move some pieces around right, to figure it out. It's not, you know, you don't have to have your bullpen settled on June 1st, July 1st, August 1st, or even September 1st to win a World Series, because there are ways of figuring it out. And I think the championship teams have proven that. So I think it's important for both teams to address it, but because they haven't figured it out now, and we're, you know, this far into the season, doesn't mean that it's going to come back and haunt them in October, because, you know, you've also seen guys who just magically have good. I remember when the Yankees traded for David Weathers in 96, and he was not very good in the regular season. All of a sudden, he's pitching great outings for them in the division series against Texas. And you're like, wow, this guy's amazing. And how great has he been? Where would we be without him? Blah, blah, blah. Graham Lloyd, same kind of thing. You know, he didn't pitch particularly well, but gets a couple of lefties out and he gets invited back to every old timers day. I mean, this is, there are ways around it, even if it doesn't look like it on July 25th as we speak.
Yes, but you better have the inventory to find the guy who can do it. And you're right about the extra guys coming out of the rotation. That's been big. I mean, the Nationals used Patrick Corbin in the playoffs as a reliever, and he was a huge element for them. You know, that depth is so important. Guys emerging in bullpens are so important. You know, I know a lot of Met fans were a little rankled because they traded Colin Holderman in the Vogelbach deal to the Pirates, and he had kind of emerged as a useful bullpen piece. And you know, but there, if the club feels like they have other options who can, you know, but guys who can do that, then I guess you make that sacrifice there, because they do need the slugging so badly. But you know, the Yankees, and you know this, Sweeney, they've done a good job of developing arms in recent years, so they've had enough. They've had depth where they can. It's been a little tested this year because they've had some depth injuries. Luis Gil is one of the guys I'm thinking of.
Yep.
And some of the, you know, obviously at the major league level, they've had some injuries too. But you have to have fodder to find something in the bullpen. Maybe that's not a very sensitive word to use, but guy, like, look, but the bullpen can be a war of attrition sometimes. You know, you just have to see how many guys you can get to find a guy who emerges and becomes someone that you can trust. And I think that that's why the trade deadline for both teams is so important, because they need to just wallpaper the bullpen with guys in case more things happen as the season goes along. You know, some pitchers don't figure it out, some pitchers do, but you got to have guys in place to get in there.
You're right. Fodder probably isn't a very sensitive word, but yeah, the idea is that you also, teams are looking ahead, and the Yankees have always been very good at this. You know, you look ahead at how many guys you're going to have to protect at the end of the season in your minor right, league system. So you're going to have to filter some of those guys out, and you start trading guys. They traded a couple infielders last year to Pittsburgh and got Clay Holmes, and yeah, they traded guys who were going to have to protect or could knock off the 40-man roster. There's a lot of 40-man churning that happens too. And sometimes you lose guys that turn out to be something. And sometimes you end up getting guys who turn out to be something, as the Yankees did with Holmes or with Michael King and things like that. So there's some of those deals to be had too. And you're right, there's a lot of people in the system that get churned out for those reasons. So it'll be an interesting couple of, you know, listen, by the time people listen to this, maybe some deals will be happening. happening. So who knows? And I've got about three or four other topics that we could hit. But, you know, listen, that means just we should just do this again another time, maybe in a couple of weeks. Maybe before the next Subway series, we'll hit this again and see how our thoughts and predictions and ideas have come in the course of a month. But Anthony McCarron writes everywhere, including for the Daily News still, and you see him on SNY. So make sure you follow him at Anthony McCarron. That's correct, right?
Yes. Yeah. On Twitter. That's me.
Okay.
Yeah.
At Anthony McCarron, and you watch him on SNY. And occasionally we get to mix it up on there as well. This has been WFAN's Baseball Insiders for Monday, July 25th. Thank you all for listening. Make sure to subscribe and review and all that jazz. Until next time, for Anthony, I'm Sweeney Murdy.
Sometimes in football, you need just a little more for that first down. You need to be pushing the pile. And on our new podcast, we'll give you that extra effort.
I'm Mike Renner, a longtime NFL analyst who helped develop player evaluation systems that every NFL team uses to this day.
And I'm Kyle Long, former All-Pro offensive lineman in the NFL who knows a thing or two about getting people moving.
You'll get expertise from inside the trenches and behind the tape for four episodes every week. So make sure you download and subscribe to the Pushing the Pile podcast on the Odyssey app.